President Obama making his statement after Vice President Joseph Biden. When it comes to protecting the most vulnerable among us, we must act now. Let's do the right thing for them and for this country, he said. And he started by saying the first task as a society is keeping our children straight, safe, and that's how we will be judged. And their voices should tell us to make a change. President Obama signing the executive orders he can sign in terms of mental health, emergency plans, strengthen background check system, and provide the mental health people in charge of mental health issues the tools he says they need to report violence. Even though, as he reiterated, most mental health people with mental health issues are more likely to be victims of violence than to be perpetrators. I'm Steve Scherer. This is, we roll into weekday here. I want to bring in a couple of folks who are listening to this as well. Beth Flynn is Executive Director of Washington Ceasefire. Beth Flynn, thanks for talking to us.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. And Phil Watson is Director of Special Projects at the Special Second Amendment Foundation. Phil Watson, thanks for talking to us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So the President, he threw out something to you, and I want you to respond to it. He was basically saying that those who support the Second Amendment issues have to also think about the children, and that our first task as a society is keeping children safe. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, I would actually agree with that, which is why I personally I can't understand why he didn't address the gun-free zones that his children are allowed to be guarded in while most children.
I gotta call you on that one. I heard that this morning too. You're really gonna say that because President Obama has security, he's a hypocrite on these issues?
Don't interrupt me, please.
Go ahead.
You know, the thing is, Obama is acting on executive orders, which is debatable on whether he can do this on some Second Amendment grounds, and this is done to satisfy a certain part of his base that is comprised of, which includes him. When he was a state senator, he signed on to a bill that said that you are not allowed to defend yourself with a handgun, even in your own home. So this is not necessarily. Part of this, the direction that we believe it should go. Most gun owners don't have a problem with a background check. The problem is the background check necessarily isn't up to date with the NICS system, and there's a lot of mental health issues that go along with this, and I'm afraid that it doesn't go far enough to address those issues that the gun owners are concerned about. So on one hand, I think I saw a lot of grandstanding, but on the other hand, there might be some things that we can support, but the problem is the devil's always in the details, and in the past, they've tried to put kind of poison pills in this legislation.
Well, he talks about wanting more support for school security, more funds for mental health care, then the background checks on all buyers, banning high-capacity magazines and banning some assault weapons, military-grade assault weapons. Are those things that you think you can get behind?
Well, the problems with the magazines and the assault the so-called assault weapons that he's trying to push on this is full automatic weapons have been banned in the United States since 1986. So I'm not sure where he's going with that, or if this is just some kind of political thing, so he can you know look like he's doing something. So I'm curious to understand what he's actually talking about with the so-called assault weapons. And quite honestly, I thought it was kind of a joke to talk about straw buyers with his attorney general standing right there in front of him. Who still hasn't, him and his administration still hasn't come clean on this Fast and Furious thing where they gave thousands and thousands of guns and what he would call assault weapons to criminals. I think it's a joke. And they need to come clean on that, and they need to do it now.
So not standing down, not a support for the ban on the high-capacity magazines at all?
Well, what's high capacity?
Well, what did he say? More than, I forget the number he gave. Seven? I think he said seven rounds.
So if what are you supposed to do if more than one person is coming after you? I mean, there was a lady down in Georgia the other day who had two people one person break into her house, and she shot him six times. The guy got up and walked out. If she would have had eight bullets in her gun, Obama would want to put her in jail. So this entire thing around how many bullets are in your gun or what kind of gun you have, which is currently legal, is a charade. We need to focus on, and it won't say, let me be clear, it's not going to save one life. And this charade around that is going to put people in jeopardy that only want to defend themselves. And we need to focus on the stuff that's going to have the most impact and that's going to pass. So I really would take issue with this stuff that, you know, again, he's doing to satisfy a certain segment of his base, which he is a part of. So I'm not sure what exactly he's going after there. If he was serious about that, he should have addressed it in his first term.
And all right, Phil Watson, let me turn to Beth Flynn here from Washington Ceasefire. Phil Watson's with Second Amendment Foundation. Beth Flynn, President clearly is going to have to has his job, and he also says the American people's job. Which of those proposals that he made to go to Congress are you going to most vociferously support?
Well, Steve, actually, we are partnering with Senator Ed Murray on an assault weapons ban in Washington State. We would like to see all three of those actions on a federal level, the universal background checks, the assault weapons ban, and the limit to the magazine number. And the number of bullets, actually, that he mentioned was 10.
Yes, 10 limit on magazines.
Yeah, and I want to go back to something that Mr. Watson said. The Second Amendment in the Heller decision in 2008 did affirm the individual right to possess a firearm in the home for self-defense. But that decision also said that conferring a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever, that it should not be seen as conferring a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever for whatever purpose. So every step that President Obama outlined today fits well within the law of the Second Amendment.
How difficult do you think it's going to be to require a universal background check for anyone buying a gun? Now, people who are just informally selling one gun to another, maybe a collector, isn't that going to be very difficult? This is person to person in somebody's home.
Yes, I do. I think it's going to be extremely difficult. It's going to involve multi-levels of changes. The feds themselves have to tighten up their database, and then they have to start requiring the states to comply with reporting to the national database. So it's going to be a very difficult process. You know, I think the president repeated that multiple times in his speech today, and it's going to require the will of the people. There are going to need to be partnerships and coalitions of people coming together to support the president and, you know, to support their legislators in pushing for this.
Do you see yourself sitting? Have you sat down with some of the supporters of gun rights to come up with ideas that both sides can support?
We are in the process of building those partnerships and coalitions right now. But I did want to mention that we actually are partnering with the Second Amendment Foundation, Senator Adam Klein, and Representative Chris Hurst on a piece of legislation. In this session, it's an underage possession legislation. So we already have partnered with the Second Amendment Foundation, and we do recognize, as the president said, it's going to take an extensive conversation with stakeholders across the state and across the nation.
I want to read you just a few of the last few parts of the executive orders that he's proposing. Direct the Attorney General to issue a report on the availability and most effective use of gun safety technologies. Challenge the private sector to develop new technologies. Clarify the Affordable Care Act does not prohibit doctors asking their patients about guns in the home. Release a letter to healthcare providers clarifying that no federal law prohibits them from reporting threats of violence to law enforcement authorities. Provide incentives for schools to hire school resource officers. Develop emergency plans. Release a letter to state health officials clarifying the scope of mental health services that Medicaid plans must cover. Finalize regulations essential to health benefits and parity requirements with the Affordable Care Act, funding mental health parity, finalizing mental health parity regulations, and then launching a dialogue. Do you think those are effective and important steps that need to be taken? Are they enough in terms of mental health issues?
They are steps. I mean, obviously some of those factors wouldn't have prevented the Cafe Racer incident, as an example. My understanding is that the shooter was not involved in any kind of mental health treatment. So for people who are actively involved in mental health treatment and they are being seen by a mental health professional, you know, of course there's an opportunity to intervene. There are many people that fall through the cracks and are not known to a mental health professional, and so this is where I think education of family members and empowering family members is a very important component of an intervention as well.
How important is the assault weapons ban to Washington ceasefire?
It's very important.
Is it the critical? Is it a critical piece of this effort? The critical piece of this effort?
The three pieces of legislation that the president mentioned are also three pieces of legislation that we would like to see. The assault weapons ban, the ban on high-capacity magazine clips, and close the gun show loophole. Because we have Senator Ed Murray sponsoring the assault weapons ban and partnering with us, that's what we're focusing on right now, along with the underage possession legislation. Would we like to see more? Yes, of course we would. That just happens to be the piece of legislation that we're currently working on. We had it before the state legislature in 2009, and it didn't get out of committee. So we've dusted off that piece of legislation and rewritten it even tighter than it was written before, and that's what we'll be working with.
So, Phil Watson, I'm looking at the criteria of an assault weapon and how it's defined in this country and how it was banned. I was just wondering, are there any of these weapons, you think, these military-grade weapons that should be banned?
Well, first of all, I'd like to address something that Beth said about the Heller decision. The Heller decision also said weapons that are in common use are cannot be banned. So I think the debate's going to probably go to what is really in common use and what people like Beth think should be banned. I think if you ask most people like Beth, off the record, probably, of course, they probably want to ban all guns or just have guns that is the video that James O'Keefe put out yesterday, just want to have one bullet in it, which I mean most people think is pretty silly.
Well, what would you ban?
Excuse me?
What would you ban? Would you ban an AR-15?
AR-15s are in common use, and they're single-shot, semi-automatic rifles. And if you go by the Heller decision, weapons that are in common use are not you're not supposed to ban them.
A Tech 9.
So what's that?
A Tech 9. Would you ban a Tech 9?
I'm not sure that Tech 9s are in common use, but that kind of gun, which is a modified handgun. I'm not sure if that you could even necessarily classify that as an assault weapon. So all this debate on what you would ban or what you wouldn't ban is kind of going around in circles. because it doesn't focus on really what's going to do the most help and keep bad people away from guns and keep people safe. So what we're really looking at is two sides of this debate here. One, people that believe in the right to keep and bear arms for the purposes of self-defense, and the purposes that it was created and it was upheld in the Supreme Court, and the other people, the people that want to slowly erode that. So what we're seeing this debate kind of shift in the media. And in political circles around, okay, well, what should we ban? And they're trying to parse out little segments of the Second Amendment that they want to go after, kind of bit by bit. And that's what I think upsets most Second Amendment activists and supporters, is that when they see this stuff, most of them, I mean. We have a lot of, I mean, cops that are members, ex-law enforcement, veterans, military, and when they hear the talk around this assault weapon stuff, they just tune out, because they know that's not going after the people that commit these kind of acts, which are extremely violent criminals and mentally ill people.
Well, you heard the president lay out the numbers of people who were killed in the last month with guns. I know you could talk about cars and other ways people died, but he ended it by saying, we don't live in isolation. We live in a society responsible for each other. And he said that, you know, the right to worship, right to assemble, right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness was denied those people through gun violence. What'd you make of that argument?
I thought that was, you know, kind of a political grandstanding move.
Well, he's essentially saying you don't care about the safety of children, isn't he? He's saying you don't care about the safety of children.
He's trying to project that you don't care about. Look, you don't care about people if you don't support what I support. And I think that's kind of, you know, that doesn't help the situation at all.
Why is that? Isn't he trying to draw a line that you know, when people drop their kids off from school, they should always feel safe? And he's trying to take some steps to take it.
So it's. I think if he would have left the kind of, you know, the little jabs and insults at people out of it, and kind of made this a more solid proposal that could have passed or could have gotten a lot of support, actually from people in the Second Amendment community, and honestly, a lot of independents and people that only want a gun for self-defense, I think he would have gotten a lot of support. But as I keep coming back to, this is aimed at a certain segment of his base, not even all of his base that agree with him that guns are not for self-defense.
All right. Phil Watson, Second Amendment Foundation, and Beth Lynn of Washington Ceasefire responding to the president's announcement of his executive action and his call on Congress to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines above 10 shots. I appreciate you talking to us and giving your opinions and listening to the president with us. We will, of course, be hearing about this ban and the president's proposal from Biden's committee throughout the day, and we'll continue to cover it as well. This is Weekday.
Rory Barnes is a University of Washington astronomer, and he says there might be life on distant moons. We'll talk with him to learn more in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms and More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, offering consumer education seminars on selecting a mattress, 9:30 Saturday mornings. Information online at howtoshopforamattress.com.
33 degrees in Seattle. Scattered fog. Forecast says it's going to wind up mostly sunny today with an afternoon high of 43. Then clear overnight, dropping down to 28. And tomorrow, Thursday, foggy again in the morning, sunny again in the afternoon, and once again a high of 43.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Mini Medical School, a six-week lecture series designed to educate the public about medical education, research, and clinical care at UW Medicine. Sessions start February 5th and are open to the public. Registration at uwmedicine.org/minimed.
We're going to turn to Bruce Harrell now, who is a Seattle City Council member and announced that he is running for mayor of Seattle as well. Another hat in the ring. Bruce Harrell, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So here we are following the president's talk. You have been looking at issues of gun violence and security in this city. You've talked about cameras for police officers as a way to help regulate what's happening between citizens and the police. You've also looked at gun issues. Now, you haven't seen all the executive orders. Let me just read you a couple of them, because you were coming in while he was talking. You were here while he was talking. Issue a presidential memorandum to require federal agencies to make relevant data available to the federal background check system. Address unnecessary legal barriers relating to the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act that may prevent some of that information from going on. Improve incentives for states to share information on the background check. Propose rulemaking to give law enforcement the ability to run full background check on individual before returning a seized gun. Direct the Attorney General to review categories of individuals prohibited from having a gun so dangerous people don't slip through the cracks. Publish a letter to the ATF to federally licensed gun dealers providing guidance on how to run background checks for private sellers. Launch a national safe and responsible gun ownership campaign. Review safety standards for gun locks, and then require a federal law enforcement to trace guns recovered in criminal investigations. So, doesn't sound like he closed the loophole, does it? In that,
I don't read that into it. But what is interesting?
The loophole on gun shows.
Yeah, the gun show loophole. You know, all of that actually sounds like solid policy. Once again, you know, when I talk about public safety in Seattle, what we've historically done is, you know, we have a preemption law in the state. What we've historically done is rely on Olympia to try to solve our problems in Seattle. There's a preemption law, RCW 941290, that suggests that or requires that that a city cannot impose any kind of more harsh regulation with respect to guns than the state. So we have to rely on the state to solve our problems. And one of the platforms that I've suggested is that we lead an effort to get out from under that exemption. Seattle is by far three times the largest city in this state. We have unique problems. I would suggest that cities like Spokane and Tacoma and other smaller cities would have similar problems, but they're very tiny cities. Do they have the same types of gun challenges that we have? And so if we can get out from under that state preemption, then we can have city regulators or city legislators help enforce more reasonable laws. And then we can do things like ban the assault weapon, ban assault weapons, or take away a gun if someone is intoxicated. I mean, we could get more creative and more reasonable in our approach. We cannot get these things passed in Olympia, and I don't think that a city should have to wait for that kind of relief.
So since we'll tie this into your announcement, what would you as mayor be able to do that you can't do as city council member, for example,
to
pursue these issues?
What the mayor can do, the mayor has a huge pulpit. A mayor can inspire the voters outside of the city hall, to put this on the ballot. And the mayor should have the analytics to know that. If you look strategically, we have not been able to do this in Olympia. We haven't been able to impose reasonable sanctions against for a juvenile, for example, that's caught 3, 4, 5 times with a gun. A 13-year-old should not have a gun. So we have been stalled, basically. But time and time again, if you look at the legislative agenda of the city, we ask for the same things. Let's close the gun show loophole. Let's ban assault weapons. And no one has stepped back and said, well, wait a minute, what's more of a strategic approach to making sure we get the kind of relief? And so what I've suggested is we take it to the people. We have to take it to the people, because I think ordinary people, not special interest groups, understands this issue. And again, the counter argument against my approach has been, well, someone's, you know, driving a car from one city to the next, and all of a sudden they're exposed to different gun regulations, and that's very confusing for the citizen. I don't buy that argument. I think that defies common sense, that I don't think that a person's going to drive from Seattle to Tacoma and all of a sudden be confused about reasonable gun regulations. I think we're used to different small, different jurisdictions, and that's not a confusing element of driving a car, for example. So I just think it defies common sense.
What did you make of the police commission that was the membership that was announced yesterday? And again, somebody who's announcing running for mayor, what would you be doing differently?
Well, on the commission specifically, I wouldn't have entered into the settlement agreement, number one, that the mayor entered into.
So you would not have?
No, I would not have. And I made it crystal clear that that was, I think, a result of not knowing what outcome you're trying to drive, that the Department of Justice had examined many documents and made some unilateral decisions about our police department. The first thing I would have done is sent a signal to our police department, many of whom, most of whom, are outstanding individuals. I would have sent a message to them that before I enter into agreement that defines what you do, I will know the data. So I wouldn't have negotiated any kind of agreement in a leveraged position. And I would have sent a signal to the Department of Justice that while there is unreasonable force used, we don't buy the 20% number that no one pushed back on. So that's the first point. The second point would be with respect to the Community Police Commission.
So you've just done that. So sure. You think the DOJ was wrong? They were too harsh in their accusations of the Seattle Police Department.
They'd never even shared with us the data that they examined to reach their conclusions. And as an attorney, I don't negotiate deals when we haven't agreed upon the data. At least I want to know what data you have used to ask me to do certain things. Now, as you well know, as a community activist, I've been very outspoken about unreasonable force. I do not tolerate it at all, personally and professionally. So I'm not suggesting that unreasonable force has not been used. What I'm suggesting is as an agreement that binds the city for years to come, I would not have entered into agreement without knowing full well the data that's relied on to be the basis for the agreement. And if the mayor truly embraces some kind of reform, which ostensibly he does because by virtue of entering into the agreement, then he should have supported Merrick Bob, who was the monitor appointed, because clearly he wrote the book on accountability and reform. He is the expert in this field. So to say I embrace accountability but I oppose the leading expert in this field to me is a contradiction, which once again suggests the fact that he didn't have a clear outcome he was trying to drive.
By the way, you support Merrick Bob.
I certainly did.
In this position.
I certainly did.
All right, moving forward, if you were mayor, what changes would you bring to the police department? And what changes would you, bring to this DOJ agreement?
Well, you know, I don't even use the term reform of the police department. The form of the department is good. What we need is a cultural change. We need those outstanding officers that are doing a great job, those that will call out unreasonable force. We need them to be the change agents within the city. So what that means from a practical standpoint is you meet with the command staff. This concept of firing the chief this is nonsense. What you do is, first of all, the chief is not the sole leader in that department. He has a command staff of three individuals, Assistant Chief Kimmerer, Metz, and Pugel. The four combined have over 100 years of police experience. You meet with them to make sure that they can be the change agents that we want. And you have to ask them, do you have the tools to succeed? Then you find the informal leaders within the police department. And there are many that embrace social justice, that embrace accountability. And you make sure that they have the microphone and they are put in leadership positions to help move the needle in terms of cultural change. And then you make sure you're using technology the wisest way. And that's why I'm a proponent of body cameras, that what you do in an alleyway and what you do at Starbucks, if you are under duress, that you should use that as a teaching mechanism to show I treat people with respect. And so it has to be a multi-pronged approach, but firing people is not the answer. Inspiring them and making sure they have the tools to succeed is how you effectuate cultural change.
Bruce Harrell is here. He's announced that he's running for mayor of the city of Seattle. Let me shift to some other issues just to cover them a little bit. And Publicola had an interview with you, and you said that the challenge with the current mayor, he's shown flat leadership. For example, on the tunnel, style becomes substance when you tell a voter base you're not going to oppose it, then you waste a couple of years based on a cost overrun theory that is a flawed theory. Why was it a flawed theory? Wasn't the McGinn's argument that we need to get the state to take us, we voters of Seattle, off the hook for any overruns?
It was a flawed theory because it was incorrect, that you rely on, it was a legal conclusion, and he and I both are attorneys, but if you rely on the opinion of the attorney general, you rely on the opinion of the city attorney, you will have concluded that that for a municipality like the city of Seattle to be on the hook for cost overruns for a state project, that was an incorrect conclusion of law. We have no control on most of those costs. So how can you hold a jurisdiction liable for costs you cannot control? You can only hold a jurisdiction liable for those costs that are within your control. So I thought that was a way to scare the voters into thinking that all of a sudden you Seattleites are going to have to pay for a state project. And there's absolutely no precedent for that. And so again, I think it was a flawed theory, and the voters spoke on this. The voters were like, we've had enough of this debate. Let's move on with the project. I actually was a supporter of the surface transit option before all this had come about, and people would have suggested me and others on the council who were also surface transit option advocates were always pro-tunnel, and many of us were not. So that's why I said that was flawed leadership.
You've also said he hasn't had enough creative initiatives in his efforts as mayor. And you point out, you argue that the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, which he supported, he's put money into, but it was Greg Nichols' initiative. And you said that's one small part of the equation. So give me a creative notion that you have in terms of dealing with young people.
Sure.
Violence being part of that, and what you would do creatively.
Sure. Two things. One is the notion of a community center has to change. I will call these empowerment centers, and I've gone down to Los Angeles and I've talked to other people that have these empowerment centers in place. But the notion of an empowerment center is, number one, for a kid to succeed, a student to succeed, I think they need three things. They need the resource around them like a tutor. They need a positive role model around them so they can see someone that has succeeded that looks like them and talks like them. And they need good teachers that are willing to be competent and know how to inspire these kids. That's what the city of Seattle can do. And so by using these community centers as empowerment centers, we can bring in mentors, bring in tutors, teach them to environmental sustainability, teach them nonviolent behavior, have a curriculum that teach them how to be more effective as human beings.
You're shifting funds from somewhere else?
No, we actually have money in a general subfund to do this.
And we had to close our community centers for some time a few years back, and when we didn't have the money.
And we restored. And see, that's the point is we look at community centers as just that. I don't need to teach another kid how to play basketball. I don't need that. I need to teach kids how to be empowered and how to self-actualize. And so what I'm suggesting that the city has valuable resources, many community centers and libraries throughout the city. Are we using these to support our public school system? You may recall that McGinn talked about taking over the school system. And that was his concept. And that, to me, is also an absurd proposition here in Seattle because that's not our role. Our role is to look at our assets and think what we can do to supplement the school system, bringing in those three components, mentorship, tutoring, self-image creation, these kinds of things. The other piece I'd bring in is a program known as Saving the Streets and Saving Seattle and Saving Souls, a lot of S's. I think that sometimes we invest in the wrong people. I think that we have people in Seattle, faith-based leaders, mentors, gang outreach workers, people that have come from that kind of life when you see kids loitering around and not doing what they're supposed to do. We have people like that that effectively right now as we speak are reaching out to these children. We need to use that as a strategic tool and actually put structure around that. So I talked about creating community service officers, CSOs, to facilitate this in all of our communities and streets.
Is there, what would you say to people who say there's a divide between North and South Seattle? Or perhaps it's a divide between communities of color and majority white, majority liberal people in Seattle. And if you agree with that connection, what's the problem and what's the solution?
I agree that our city is fragmented not only by those demographics, but by fragments, labor, business, enviro community, educational advocates, social justice advocates. But I will tell you that wasn't the Seattle that I've known and the Seattle that I see in the future, that I think, again, we need a mayor that can bridge all of these gaps. I mean, I have friends with some of the strongest civic leaders in this city and friends that have recently gotten out of prison. I mean, my span of friendship and support spans that way because that's the life that I've led in terms of trying to bridge these communities. So I would fully agree that we have separate Seattles to some extent. You know, both my grandparents on my Japanese side and my African-American side came here in Seattle in the 30s and 40s, and they had great opportunity, but they also had a societal sort of form of compassion that allowed them to succeed, to be homeowners, to start businesses and thrive in businesses. And then we had, I think, a better spirit. When the Seahawks lost a couple of days ago, and I'm still in mourning, by the way, what did we see? We saw people that don't even follow football get behind television and start rooting this team. This city can be better with the right kind of inspirational leadership, and that's what I hope to bring.
All right. Bruce Harrell is a Seattle City Council member. He's running for mayor. I look forward to a longer conversation. I appreciate you talking to us and accommodating the president.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you. This is Weekday.
Thirty-four degrees in Seattle. Quite a bit of fog in some areas. Forecast says it's going to wind up mostly sunny later with a predicted high today of 43.
Over the years, membership contributions have brought great programming to you, our listeners. Creating a legacy gift to benefit KUOW builds a bridge from one generation of public radio listeners to the next. To learn more about how you can include KUOW in your estate plans, go to kuow.org/support-future.
You remember those choose-your-own-adventure books that put the reader in control of the story's ending? Well, you imagine the debt ceiling is one of those adventures, and things get interesting.
President Obama could say, listen, I'm going to put an option on Alaska to sell Alaska, give it to the Federal Reserve in exchange for a couple trillion dollars, pay all the bills, avoid the default.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. You write the story next time on Marketplace from APN.
Tonight at 6:30 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting the Vancouver Symphony in concert on January 23rd at Benaroya Hall, featuring Grieg's Piano Concerto and Prokofiev's Symphony No. 5. Tickets online at seattlesymphony.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:53. News out of Algeria today. Islamist militants have attacked a gas field and are claiming to have kidnapped up to 41 foreigners, including 7 Americans. More about that in the news at 10. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Now a shorter than we intended, but conversation about whether there's life on other planets and what Rory Barnes is learning as research scientist in the Department of Astronomy at the University of Washington, where he's co-authored a research study explaining the possibility of life on exomoons. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Steve.
What's an exomoon?
And
why isn't it a planet?
Yeah, so an exomoon is kind of what it sounds like. It's a moon of a planet that's orbiting another star. So we call planets orbiting another star exoplanets. So therefore, we call their moons exomoons.
And why do we think exomoons offer the possibility of life?
Well, they are solid objects, and we think that solid objects like the Earth are the best places to look for life. And so it's natural to then think if moons of planets that are solid, like some of them, like our moon or some of the moons of Jupiter, exist around other planets, around other stars, they might also be habitats for life.
So what have you been finding?
So what we've looked at is just basically what are the requirements for life on an exomoon? The classic way of thinking about this is to look at the incoming starlight. There's this concept that's kind of well known called the habitable zone, sometimes called the Goldilocks zone, where we think the right amount of starlight can produce liquid water on a moon, on a moon or on a planet. So we start there, and then we look at there are some other funny things that happen on moons that make the situation slightly more complicated.
Like?
So, for example, one of the moons of our solar system is called Io. It is a moon of Jupiter, and it is the most volcanically active body in the solar system. There's constantly supervolcanoes going off on Io's surface. But Io, it turns out, it could be potentially kind of wimpy in the galaxy. We could imagine moons that are incredibly more volcanic than that. And the reason why is actually something called tidal heating. Basically, Io's shape is constantly getting flexed by the gravitational pull of Jupiter. And so if you could imagine something like the size of the Earth orbiting some exo-Jupiter around another star, it might actually be tidally heated to the point that it actually heats the surface to the point that all the water boils off and the moon would no longer be habitable. So there are some sort of some funny things about exomoons that we've looked at. That's a big one. Another fun aspect of the exomoons is the possibility of the planet actually blocking the starlight during eclipses. So an eclipse on an exomoon could last for hours, and that can actually change how the temperature on certain parts of the planet might evolve.
So the Kepler Space Telescope is looking for these exoplanets and exomoons.
Correct.
We know they're there through perturbations in the information that's coming back, right? I mean, you see changes in describe it for me. What are the changes you're seeing?
You're exactly right. So the Kepler spacecraft is our best exomoon hunting tool right now. And what it does is it basically looks for the light from a star to drop periodically due to an exoplanet crossing in front of the star. So we can imagine then that you look for maybe the dip of light due to an exomoon. Or, more complicated, but what you were alluding to, is the possibility that the moon's gravity can actually pull an exomoon around, an exoplanet around, excuse me, and that will actually change the times in which we see an exoplanet cross in front of the star from the Earth, and that perturbation can reveal the presence of an exomoon.
So given that, this is very elaborate ways of finding information out. How do you find out more about them to the point where you know that has the possibility of sustaining life?
Right. So that's obviously the next level of sophistication, is to try and actually determine, just is a moon that looks habitable, does it actually have life? And we won't be able to do that in the near future, but NASA is building some big spacecraft that we hope that will launch in the near, distant future, maybe in the next 10 to 20 years.
And we'll still be working on it.
I'll still be working on it. But we'll hopefully be able to find look at these planets or these moons with these big, big telescopes that are going to be in space. And so actually identifying an inhabited moon is still at least 20 years off, I would say. But it's in the works. We have big long-term goals that we're dreaming about. And so hopefully we'll be able to determine this in our lifetimes.
So right now, what, the 850 extrasolar planets have been identified?
Yeah, for certain there are that many. There's probably more like 4,000.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, well, the Kepler spacecraft, it has found a lot of candidates, is what we like to call them. That put candidates in quotes there. We don't know for certain that they are planets, but it looks like very likely that at least 90 or 95% of them are, and they found something like 3,000. So there's that extra 3,000 exoplanets on top of the 850 that are confirmed definitely planets.
Are you putting the planets and the moons in the same category? Or?
Well, we have not found any exomoons yet. So we're trying to think ahead, and with the hope that Kepler will actually find some of these planets in the habitable zone that then have an exomoon, in the hopes that then we could characterize right away, you know, is this a good place to look for life?
What's the machine that's going to let you actually get to the detail of finding exomoons?
Kepler has the power to do that. You know, the question is just, will it be able to find the right sorts of configurations of planets and moons to actually detect them? You know, that's unknown right now, and it's not going to be the easiest thing to pull out of the data. They're smaller than planets, so they're harder to find.
You pouring over that data now?
I'm not really pouring over it. I'm more of the theorist. I try and just figure out what the observers are telling me.
Oh, I see.
How to interpret it, yes.
And you leave it to the graduate students.
Never.
Rory Barnes is a research scientist at the Department of Astronomy, University of Washington, looking for life, looking for moons, looking for exomoons, exoplanets. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
This is Weekday.